much too strong. I'm added to you. Change, change, change.
Hello and welcome to In The Mood For Podcast with Callum Reid and Pete Shepherd. And this is the second installment. Last week's was a little long.
It was.
To say the least. And it took me about 4 hours to edit it, but we got there in the end.
Yeah, eventually.
Yeah. So this week we have the trailer of Django Unchained by Quentin Tarantino to discuss.
Mm.
Your favourite filmmaker?
Yes.
And we also have to discuss The Pact and The Innkeepers, the two horror films released this week in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Although The Innkeepers has been released for about 3 months in the US.
Oh, right, okay.
And then we have a few other stuff.
Odds and ends,
yeah. And then we're going to cap it off with a discussion of Snow White.
So if you want to skip to the end and listen to Snow White, then feel free. Yeah.
If you like Snow White, or if you hate it.
Yeah.
It'd be best if you hate it.
Or if you're a twihard secretly. A closet twihard. I don't think we're going to be getting many closet twihards.
No, they're pretty vocal, aren't they?
Mm.
We're going to talk about the big releases. Are they big releases? They're probably not, are they?
Well, they're releases.
They're releases. Two horror releases. The Pact. Starts off with The Pact. What's it about?
The Pact, it kind of shuffles along, actually. The structure is rather interesting. The basic setup is that there's a woman played by Katie Lotz who is a former junkie, and she's come back to her childhood home to organise her mother's funeral. And in the first couple of reels, things start going bump in the night. Her sister disappears, and it seems as if it's just going to be a usual thing. But then it gets pushed into more supernatural directions, and also there's some other areas which
there might be other twists.
Yeah, there's other twists and other directions it goes into. Turns into a bit of a mystery at one point, and then it has the finale that you'd expect in this sort of film. That's the basic rundown of it without giving too much away, because it's very easy to give a lot away because it's not a long film and it's very compartmentalized. It's in basically four clear cut structures, and I think what I liked about it the most is that it does the usual things but doesn't do them in the usual way. So when it goes for the jumps, it's a little sly with the direction. It's a debut director, McCarthy. What's his name? Nicholas McCarthy?
Yeah, Nicholas McCarthy.
Nicholas McCarthy. And apparently it's extended from a short that he did. And
which I think is available on Vimeo for anyone who wants to know.
Oh, right. Good, good, good.
Although I haven't seen it, but...
No, neither have I. No.
But I can't imagine all of this, the plot that's in this film, being in the short.
I think it would be very much the stuff going bump in the night.
Yeah.
I would have guessed.
The one scene particularly.
Yes. Yeah. The trailer for this really does it a disservice, I think. I think the trailer tries to strip it down and sell it as the normal, boring stuff in the genre that you see it all the time. And I think there's a little bit more to it than that, in that it just does it a little bit better. And especially her. What did you think about her?
I thought she was good. I don't think I've seen anything with her in it before.
I think she's on TV. I think there's something on TV, Mad Men or something like that, where she's been in a few episodes.
Right. The interesting thing as well is that this is an American film, and it really doesn't seem like an American film to me. The way that... firstly, the poster artwork, which is really interesting... And not what you expect.
Yeah, and it's not something from the film either. It's just but it gives an impression. It's quite interesting.
It's really striking.
Mm.
And just the style of it, I think, the way it kind of weaves in sort of reminiscent of Swedish crime elements to it, which is not, you know, completely original, but...
I don't think many things in this genre are.
I don't think anything is, but you don't see that very often, especially in kind of mainstream horror films, which is, this has kind of been billed as, but isn't really.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah, it's billed as because it's getting a release, and it's getting a release in multiplexes. So in that respect, it is mainstream.
Yeah. I think it's probably going to earn a lot of money, I would imagine.
Yeah,
well, a sizable chunk.
Relatively, yes. Yes, definitely. She was in a TV show called Death Valley, and she had 3 episodes on Mad Men, Katie Lotz. I think I've told you this before. I think this is the sort of film that is a Melissa George film without Melissa George in it. which kind of... And the thing with Melissa George is when she does these sort of thriller, horror-type things, like your Triangles and... I can't even remember the name of the other one, which I saw. It's the one in the woods with the kidnapped girl.
I was going to say The Cold Light of Day. Time to Die?
Yeah.
A Lonely Place to Die.
That's the one. I would have been all over that last week. Those two. They're not bad films. They're not great films, but they really do deliver what they set out to do, and they're not boring, and they're not they're not trite, which most things are. And with this, I think. I don't think it was a brilliant performance from her, but I think it was really solid. And I liked that she's got this really strong physique, big shoulders, strapping thighs. She looks like she can handle herself.
She rides a bike as well.
Yeah, motorbike riding, leather jacket wearing. I mean, she looks tough. Well, she's supposed to be a junkie, but she looks tough. And so when you mix that physicality with the vulnerability and the family history, and there's clear psychological stuff going on, and she's just lost her mother. So you've probably got about 3 or 4 different things that are making her vulnerable, aside from whatever's going on in the house. It's a nice visual thing when you've got this strong looking woman who clearly isn't in a strong place mentally. Yeah.
There's also an interesting turn from this young woman who's supposed to be a medium.
Yeah, she was really good.
Yeah, and she goes a bit insane, and as you would expect, that amps up the drama. But yeah, she's really effective.
Her name's Hayley Hudson. I'm just clicking on IMDb to tell you that. I didn't know that. I have seen her before. She was on Weeds for a few episodes, playing Mary Louise Parker's estranged daughter. I don't remember that when I looked it up. It's one of these ones where you see it and go, oh yes, of course, that was the daughter in Weeds. But it's one of these thankless little roles that is purely there, really. If you're analysing it, it's purely there to push the film in a different direction.
Absolutely,
it's exposition. The character is pure exposition, but she comes in there and she plays it really honestly, and it's one of these little roles that you notice and you remember. I'm glad you mentioned that one, actually, because I was going to bring it up.
Good. I mean, it's pretty episodic.
It is,
and it's the way it kind of goes from A to B to C to D. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't mess around, but it's effective, and I think it's one of the best horror films I've seen, definitely in the last couple of years, which is not saying a huge deal, but it's saying enough.
This is the thing. If you like the genre, this is a very decent in its own right. It's a very decent film, and within the genre, it is one of the better ones. I mean, again, it might not be saying much, and I suppose it depends if you like certain films which have reputations in the genre, and I wasn't the biggest fan of, say, The Descent.
Which I loved.
Yeah, which is probably what you were going back to when you said the last few years.
Yeah, there probably is.
but that's the sort of thing. So it's all relativist, but it is it's really well made, and I like the tone. The tone's pretty consistent throughout, even when the plot's going in different directions. The tone and the effective score, it adds to the tension of what's there. Sound design's good. It's very solidly made stuff.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, so what about The Innkeepers? Because I didn't see this one.
Yeah, The Innkeepers. It's about a guy and a girl who are running this hotel, The Innkeepers Hotel, which is about to be closed down in 2 days, just completely demolished. So there's only a couple of guests staying there. One of them is Kelly McGillis, who thinks she's a psychic.
She's still working.
She's back from the 80s. Yeah.
Wow.
And there's been sort of strange goings on in this hotel, and the guy who's with the lead girl, who's played by Sarah Paxton, the guy with the Luke Healy, thinks that there is a ghost in the hotel, and he has a website about it, and he's sort of proven right eventually.
Okay,
that's not really a spoiler, but
yeah.
And it's really good. In terms of, it's quite old-fashioned in terms of generating fear through the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like The Shining, in that the character sort of feels suspended in this kind of unique state of being.
Right.
But eventually it doesn't really get to where it wants to. It doesn't have a lot of drama because it's holding so much back.
Yeah.
Because it kind of wants to be different from other kind of jumps and scares kind of films.
Yeah.
So I was a little disappointed. It's by Ty West, who did The House of the Devil, which I haven't seen, but which loads of horror aficionados say is really good. But I just didn't feel it with this one. Have you seen House of the Devil?
No, I haven't, no. I probably see on average, because I actually looked this up on IMDb, I see on average about 5 or 6 horror films a year. So I don't see many. And that's what IMDb classes as, quote, horror, unquote. Because I actually wanted to look with the pact. Well, what was the last... I was actually trying to think, what was the last horror film I actually really liked? And so I put the last 10 years in, and the one that is like way ahead of everything else, even though it's not really a horror, I just consider it a normal comedy, was Zombieland. That was my number one.
See, that's not horror.
No, it's not. It's really not. But there's lots of zombies being shot, but that doesn't make it a horror film by definition.
So we can't count Shaun of the Dead as horror either, right?
No. No, I wouldn't have thought so. It counted Prometheus as horror, which we reviewed last week. And I suppose that's fair, because it does have horror set pieces in it. But it obviously has pretensions of something being something more than just a horror film. As Alien did, but Alien succeeded better.
Yeah.
In those terms. In being something more. So I take it this is one of those ones that's decent enough while you're watching it, but it's nothing that's going to linger in the memory.
Yeah, it's not as effective as it should be at the end of the day, but I think together with The Pact, this is kind of a step forward for the genre in general. And like, I would urge people to watch both of these films rather than going out and watching Chernobyl Diaries or renting Devil. Or
Devil is not good. I saw that on TV. And I watched that for Caroline Davenas, who I will watch in anything. I'm just a really big fan of hers, and she's in it for like 3 scenes, and not in a good Judy Greer 3 scenes in a rom-com way.
Was she just like the girlfriend getting out the car?
No, she was like the assistant to the cop outside the elevator.
Does she have a name in the credits?
Yeah, best friend, friendly cop or something, I'm not sure. Oh dear, that was
a killer.
That was disappointing.
Yeah, well, I think we're done with that, so So, if you want to move on to...
Yes, my stuff. This is, first up, I'm going to do Mozart's Sister, which is still out at independent cinemas around here. It's showing at the Mac this week. This is actually a couple of years old. It's a French film, and it's about the Mozart family's grand tour. And when I say it's about the Mozart family's grand tour, I mean that in the way that Braveheart is about William Wallace, in that historical accuracy is just completely thrown out of the window, to the point that it is actually a fantasy film. But I really don't care, because because it's this film. Last week we were talking about Perfect Sense, and I said it was one of those films that gets under your skin and just makes you think about it. And this film is beautiful. The sets and the costumes are just gorgeous, 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 gorgeous. Because it's set in 1760s France. Because I should read out the setup of the film. The film is that the Mozart, you got the mum and the dad, the sister who's about 14, and then young Wolfgang who's about 10. And they're travelling at really great expense on carriages, going to all these different royal courts, and they're not really getting that much money when they're there. And this is historically a point of contention. Some people think they made a load of money off these tours. Other people think they just about covered their costs. The writer-director, René Furet, is definitely going for the latter on that one. and so they meet, they stop off at... The axle breaks on the carriage. They stop off at a local nunnery to get it repaired, and she meets... This is where the fantasy element comes in. She meets the youngest three daughters of the King of France,
right?
Who in real life actually were in the nunnery. So that but it's so many decades different in real life that it's really not true.
Since when does anybody stop at a nunnery to get the carriage repaired?
I know.
This is like so bourgeois.
I know, it's genius, and. He actually has, and so she strikes up a friendship with the youngest daughter of the King of France, and because they're going to the French court, the daughter gives Nannerl, the original title is Nannerl la Sœur de Mozart, it's a nickname of the sister, and she gives her a love letter to give to someone in the French court when she gets there, and the director, René Furet, his one daughter plays Mozart's sister, and then the other daughter plays the youngest of the King of France. So not only we're getting into Coppola syndrome now, in the nepotism, but they're really good, particularly the girl playing Mozart's sister. She's really... It's not the sort of performance you'd get from an American actress. Like when you think of American child actresses, like your Abigail Breslin's, or your Chloe Moretz's, I suppose, or your Dakota Fannings. It's more Elle Fanning somewhere in that sort of very restrained, but there's a lot
refined.
It works. It really does work for the character.
And who's this girl who's playing?
It's the guy's daughter. I think her name's Marie Furet. And she's been in quite a few of his films, apparently. So she's an experienced child actress, because daddy's been doing this. I've never heard of this guy, Frey, and I've had a look at his resume on IMDb, and still clueless. I'll speed up this one. My only real problems with this film in general, because it's really, the atmosphere is great, and it suggests basically that she was really talented, and she was really talented, but she got forced to stop when she was 18 years old because you became a woman and then you had to go and get married. There's a lot of the sexism that Wolfgang's getting preferential treatment. He's getting composition classes when she never does. It suggests that she was half composing some stuff with him, and maybe it was literally she had ideas and then his genius would take over and then it would go into his compositions. And stuff like this. So again, it's all very. You don't.
Is it a bit of a smear on Mozart?
No. I don't think so because I don't think so because I think it's actually, even whether it's true or not, I don't care if it's true or not. And B, it's quite realistic the way that it's done. the way that they do it. The problem with it is that there's the, so when she gets to the French court, she strikes up a romance with the Dauphin. Daughters of the French king's brother who's there. And the only problem with it is that it doesn't really take emotionally, and that's becomes one of the more the big focal point of the story. So while the Mozart thing is all very interesting, and it's beautifully, and the atmosphere is great, and it's beautifully done and put together, that romantic anchor for the last hour or so really doesn't hit home as well as everything else does. So it doesn't make it a bad film. It doesn't even make it a decent film. It's still quite a good film with that, but it could have been better. But it would have to be a very different film, because they've gone for this fantastical, she's falls in love with the Dauphin of France, and he's got to marry someone else, and she's got her career, and it's really the brother. So
yeah. So it turns into a bit of a royal soap opera.
Yeah, but it's honestly played. It's all very elegant, which I'm a sucker for elegant stuff in period drama. I'm not a fan of the grittier attempts. I think if you're doing it in that sort of all the carriages and stuff, I don't want to see documentary style filmmaking with the carriages. Yeah. Personally,
So you want Marie Antoinette style?
Yeah, I think I'm more of a Merchant Ivory guy when it comes to that sort of thing. But I really like this film, and I'm liking it more the more I think about it. And it's a couple of years old, so the DVDs should be available. Especially after it's just been released, and it's been released for a while. And I'd recommend anyone to check it out. And bold statement of the week, which means nothing to me because I didn't like Amadeus. This is the best film I've ever seen about Mozart.
Wow.
which will annoy a lot of other people. How can you say this? But no, because I didn't like Amadeus, that's an easy call for me.
Yeah.
Next week at the Mac, also at the Lighthouse, is Monsieur Lazare, which was nominated for the foreign language Oscar last year.
Yeah,
it didn't win over A Separation, which we might get into in a couple of minutes. Just in general,
keep me the fact there.
The fact that A Separation won. this is a very simple film about a woman is a teacher of a primary school. She hangs herself in the classroom.
Whoa.
And the kids are obviously traumatized by this. They're looking for a new teacher, and this guy Bashir Lazar turns up, and it is set in Canada, Montreal, and offers to be the teacher. He claims that he's been a teacher in his native Algeria for I think 18 years, but so a very long time. It doesn't matter if it's 18 or whatever, and he gets the job. Then very quickly you see that he's actually an asylum seeker, and his lawyers are trying to keep him in the country by saying that if he returns to Algeria, where his wife and children were murdered, then there will be a real threat to his personal safety. So there's a legal battle going on in the background, and in that first scene in the courtroom, you find out he actually wasn't the teacher, his wife was, and he just ran a restaurant. So
he's an imposter, basically.
Yeah, so he's an imposter, but he's going in there. He's lost his wife, so there's an natural empathy there for him with the kids.
So it's quite like School of Rock.
There are two very obvious comparisons for this. One is the class, the French class, not the Estonian one, which is about a Columbine style tragedy. It's like the French class at its best when it's at like the French the class, in that when you've got him with the class and then it touching on some of the background stuff. There's some nice little stuff, like they can't touch the children otherwise they get in trouble, so you can't hug a child, you can't comfort a child.
Yeah.
And so you've got a PE teacher saying, you try teaching a kid how to vault a horse when you can't even touch them.
Yeah.
So I just have them running laps and whistling like an idiot. So that's when it's at its best, when it's getting into the sort of
politics.
The politics and the bureaucracy, which has already been done brilliantly in the class.
Yeah.
And that was the whole point of the class. This, there's so much character and plot going on that's only really, it only really touches in those areas on the odd occasion. The other film that it's like is The Visitor, because kind of obliquely, because it's about somebody who comes, someone who's in the, who's shouldn't be there, who touches, has an impact on people who are. The good thing about this is that it doesn't go in the obvious directions that you'd think. And the bad thing is that that as a result of that, they don't actually, it doesn't reach the dramatic potential, so it feels a bit light. So you get to the end and you think, well, that was really streamlined, it was really simple, and I think it was slightly undercooked. I think there could have been more to this. That was my feeling afterwards. But the bloke, Mohamed Falag, playing, it's just a lovely, lovely performance. It's got every single aspect of what he's being asked to do dramatically is believable. The way he is with the kids, the way he is with a female colleague who is obviously interested, the way he is with the authority, and it's a headmistress as well. So it's just little things, like you're coming from like North Africa, very different gender politics.
Is it better than Francois Bégodeau? Is it Bégodeau?
No. Yeah, yeah. No. I mean, as a performance.
Yeah.
As a performance, I prefer him. I do prefer him as a performance. But he's given so much more to do, because all he had to do was just relate to the children in the class, and then just chat and whine about stuff. So he gets... It's an unfair comparison, because Falag has so much to do, because you've got all these backdrops that inform what he's doing. So even the slightest thing that he does, you're projecting stuff onto it. But it's not just a case of him being a blank slate and then it's all you. He's very economical with what he's doing, and the way that it's written brings everything out of that. So it's note perfect. That's the director, which really has to be commended for that one, because it's the more than some of its parts in that respect. I think overall this is quite good. It's not as good as it could have been, but a very easy watch, very accessible, and this is the sort of nice little film that a lot of people would enjoy. And I can't believe more Oscar voters preferred A Separation to this.
Is this heartwarming then? Is it?
It's touching.
Is that what you
said? It is quite touching, because there is a certain children. There's one child with a single mother who's perennially absent because she's I can't remember if she's a pilot or an air stewardess. She's away on planes all the time, and that comes back to the whole, you're not allowed to comfort these kids. They're all clearly grieving, and there's one particularly that gets under his skin. So it does pull away at the emotions in a way that something as arctic as Separation certainly never did.
This was Canada's submission as well.
Canada's submission, actually in French, which is, I know a lot of Canadians didn't like the fact that Water got even sent in 2006, which was.
I quite liked Water, but yeah, it's not a Canadian film in essence.
No, it doesn't feel Canadian at all. And this is the thing. I mean, if we were picking something to represent England or the United Kingdom, you wouldn't necessarily pick a Bond film, or you wouldn't pick a film that doesn't feel British.
You might pick a Ken Loach film.
So obviously last year, if you were picking, you would have to pick The King's Speech, because you've got to think of something that might actually do well. But you would pick that over maybe something that might be more interesting, or might be certainly would be edgier. I mean, you wouldn't send Red Road. Or you wouldn't send Wuthering Heights to the Oscars last year if you were British, whether you like it or not, because it's just not going to happen. And
it would depend on who was choosing, but if it's BAFTA, then it could have been anything.
Yeah,
could have been Iron Lady.
that would be hilarious. that would be like Le Môme won the BAFTA for foreign language BAFTA, but that was in the 5-year period when everybody got to vote on foreign language, and surprise surprise, the only films that ever got nominated were those that got multiplex distribution. Thankfully BAFTA have got rid of that now.
But they still need to stop everybody being able to nominate on every category, which still happens.
Yeah, the chapter it is chapter voting, which is why David Fincher won for The Social Network. And Tom Hooper didn't win, so that was only the director's voting. I think it's the four acting categories and Best Picture everyone can vote on.
Yeah.
And the rest are chapter and jury voted. Yes, so Lazar, I'd recommend it. Broadly, I think that's a rather broad target of a film.
Okay, so we're just going to play a clip of Django Unchained, which is... as I said before, the new film from Quentin Tarantino. So here it is.
Yes! Woo! Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo! I'm a man! I want revenge! I want revenge! Gotta get some hit!
I like the way you die, boy.
Gentlemen, you had my curiosity, but now you have my attention.
What's your name?
Django. The D is silent.
So, what do you think of Django Unchained?
Oh, as a trailer or a concept?
Is it the same?
Well, I haven't seen the... Is this another one of his that's based on some film from the 60s or 70s that about seven people have seen?
Yeah, probably. It's very B movie influence, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's with all of his stuff.
Well, yes. Actually, I thought the trailer was quite good. I mean, it's
wow. That surprises me.
Well, yeah. The reason it surprises Cal is because it's not that I dislike Quentin Tarantino. It's just that I find certain things about him quite trying. And this trailer, the reason I like it. The trailer is because it doesn't actually actively look as if he's ripping something off. And I think the thing with Quentin is that the less you know about whatever he is ripping off, and he's always ripping off something, the less you know about it, the better, quite frankly.
Yeah, I mean, you say he's not ripping anything off, but there's...
Well, he doesn't seem to be ripping anything off. I mean, don't get me wrong, there was like shades of True Grit just from the cinematography in there.
Yeah.
And hints at other things, but no, it was less hackish than I was expecting.
Yeah, less obnoxious, definitely.
Yeah, but it does obviously from even just from the couple of lines you see DiCaprio doing, but mainly from Waltz and Jamie Foxx, he is obviously in full ham mode. In that these three guys are going to be mugging it up.
Yeah.
The whole way through, which is not how he used to be, really. I mean, there's not really that... I mean, apart from Sam Jackson, there's not really that much mugging in Pulp Fiction. Bruce Willis certainly isn't mugging. John Travolta certainly isn't mugging. You could say Thurman is a little bit in places, but it wasn't really his thing. And Reservoir Dogs, I mean... No, there's a lot of guys shouting a lot, but I wouldn't exactly say they're like there's the smugness looking to camera and all that, or not looking to camera, but playing it big.
Yeah, of course. There's Waltz as muggy and everything, really.
Well, yeah, he's exactly the same in Carnage. In that
exactly.
And I suppose if you're and he probably wrote this for Waltz, knowing Quentin. So if you're tailoring it to his strengths, then it could be quite entertaining. Because I mean, Christoph Waltz is a really charming bloke, and he's got a hell of a screen presence.
Yeah, he really does.
In that respect, that's perfectly watchable for me. That will get me in the cinema. Christoph Waltz strutting around doing his thing. Yep, super.
Yeah, and Leo DiCaprio's the villain for once, which was interesting.
Looking moderately charming as well. I mean, he probably really hasn't been that since Catch Me If You Can, just because of the sorts of characters and roles he's been doing. He hasn't really had to rely on the on that sort of like it, that part of his makeup as an actor. But
yeah,
I mean, he's gone very serious in the last 10 years with Your Body of Lies and your all the stuff with Scorsese.
Yeah. Was Jamie Foxx in Body of Lies as well? What was that?
No, he was in The Kingdom. That was the same time. The very similar setting. Yeah, it was Mark Strong in Body of Lies. He was wicked. Really was.
He always is.
Well, yeah. I rewatched Tinker Tailor the other night on the DVD, and he stood out more this time for me.
Yeah.
I digress. First one of the day.
Back to Django.
Yes, Django.
There's shades of McCabe and Mrs. Miller towards the end.
Yeah.
The finale.
And there's going to be some... Well, you'd assume there's going to be some Leone in there somewhere in the end product.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, well, Kill Bill was just full Leone. Maybe he's just got bored of it and he'll do something else, you never know. I doubt it, though.
What about the soundtrack to the trailer? What do you think of that?
Well, it's this is the thing with trailers. I mean, with Tarantino, it's like the soundtrack's always the bulk of it. It's like endless. And it's the way it's put together, scene after scene after scene after scene. Usually it really works. I mean, I think the one it didn't really work is with Inglourious Basterds, when you've randomly got a David Bowie song coming in out of nowhere.
Yeah, that was less about the soundtrack, really. But this one is a bit like Shaft, kind of music.
Yeah, got the exploitation vibe to it.
Yeah.
And Jamie Foxx, I think as long as he takes a back seat to Waltz, I can get on board with how he looks in the trailer if that expands out. I wouldn't want him to get into a contest with Waltz in the mugging stakes, because he's going to lose and the film's probably going to suffer for it.
I'm sure it's more of a circus around him than him fully at the front of it.
Yeah, he'll just
Although he was really good in Collateral and Lead, so...
Yeah. Oh, well, obviously. No matter what Harvey Weinstein or anyone who runs for your consideration campaigns for the Oscars to say, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's going to be a lead actor being frauded into supporting.
Yeah. Do you think, on the topic, do you think that this is going to be an awards player?
Well, I really didn't think Inglourious Basterds was going to be. And it ended up being huge. And maybe it's because the year wasn't particularly good. And I know people say the year isn't particularly good every single year on the internet, but I do think the last couple of years have been down years. It's in terms of the top end, there hasn't been as much of it for me. There haven't been as many really good films since probably 2007. That was a really deep year.
2009 was pretty bad.
Well, it wasn't as bad as last year. Last year was just really thin on the ground. But 2009, yeah. I mean, also it was with the expansion to 10 Best Picture.
Yeah, the first time, wasn't
it? But it would probably have gotten anyway, with the amount of nominations that it got.
Yeah. I don't know why. Maybe the Jewish pull. I don't know.
I don't know. Well, maybe it's just been so long since they've had a decent one that people were suddenly impressed. I don't know. Maybe it's the Brad Pitt factor. Now it's actually you can get awards if you have Brad Pitt in your film.
That suddenly happened.
Yeah, that didn't used to happen. But what about you? So, has this made you more or less anticipate? Has this increased the anticipation for you?
It hasn't. Definitely hasn't increased it. It's probably just leveled out. It was a little less serious looking than I was expecting. I thought you might kind of really make kind of a serious film this time, which it still might be, but it's not going to be the kind of artistic.
No, it's not going to be Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, it's got promise. Definitely.
It does.
I'm not too keen on DiCaprio from the clips, but...
It depends as well. I mean, they're obviously trying to, like, make him... He does look different, but he does look as if he's trying.
Yeah.
So...
I still find it difficult to look at him that old because of Titanic, I think.
Yeah.
Just expecting, curtains to pop out suddenly.
Yeah. Or Romeo and Juliet is going to be... he was really young in that.
Yeah.
Well, not quite Gilbert Grape young, but he was stupidly young looking in that, in Romeo and Juliet.
He's also in... I saw the film. What's the one that Diane Keaton got nominated for?
Oh, yes. It's...
Marvin's Room?
Marvin's Room. Streep actually got one of the precursors, and then she ended up actually getting the Oscar nomination. So to those who say that Meryl Streep gets nominated for everything, she doesn't.
That's true. Mm. But Diane Keaton was better, so justice was served on this occasion.
Well, I wouldn't have nominated either, so I don't really care. I'm not even going to... No, it's not an issue for me. But 96 was a very good year for actresses. Another digression, which I'm not going to go down. I just resisted the impulse.
Do you think Diane Keaton will ever be in a Tarantino film?
A Tarantino film? No, probably not. Unless he, if he does, then he'll probably do a Maggie Chung on her, where he'll coax her into doing it, and then just leave her on the cutting room floor, which is just reprehensible. You can't bring someone out of retirement and then cut them out of the film.
That's terrible.
That's just...
I didn't know that happened.
Yeah, she was in Inglourious Basterds, and he cut the part.
Who was she?
She was I think it was someone in Paris who she goes and sees or something. It was a subplot that he just... I mean, there's so much excess in that film anyway. I don't understand how he thought, there should be more. there's too much, so I've got to get rid of some of it, but because I just don't think that's how he rolls. But that is beyond harsh. I mean, she hadn't worked since 2004, I think. I don't think she'd done anything since Clean.
Oh dear, poor Maggie.
Quentin.
And is she retired again now?
I think she was going into doing something to do with music,
album.
Or maybe film music. She was wanting to pursue musical directions, but because she was educated and brought up over here, actually, in England.
You can tell. I think
her voice. Yeah, her voice is very, very English. Mind you, Hong Kong wasn't England, but because when Happy Together, they're travelling on the Tony Leung and Leslie Cheung are travelling on British passports. That's why I actually really think that Happy Together is technically the best British film of the 90s. because it was still 97 and we hadn't given Hong Kong back yet.
Is this the bold statement of the week?
I don't think it's that bold, really. I mean, unless you're going Secrets and Lies, there's not really much to rival it.
Okay.
Moving on.
That might be enough about Tarantino.
Yeah.
And Django Unchained, but...
Another film, which is very briefly, I think it's only out for one day next week at the Mac, which I'm not going to talk about in great detail because it's quite old. It's a 2009 film, is Welcome, which is a French film, which I really liked. I think it was one of the best films of that year. It's about a lad who's trying to... get to London to be with the love of his life, and he gets stuck just outside the crossing. Mm. And he approaches a local swimming instructor because he has a phobia, so he can't put... What they do is they when they're being transported in the vans, you put bags over your head so that they can't pick up the breathing with the searching that they use. They use some kind of search. I can't remember if it's infrared or whatever. The way that they search for it, they can see the breath. So you put the bag over your head to stop so that you don't get rumbled. Yeah. And he's claustrophobic, and that exacerbates. So he can't do it that way. So he goes to a local swimming instructor and tries to get lessons so he can swim the channel. So it's the best thing about that film, the crowning achievement, is that even though I'm British, it makes you want him to get there. even though you've got a load of asylum seekers just queuing up, even though they're in France, in a country where the rule of law applies and they're safe and they're free from tyranny, and they just want to come here because there's an extra £10 on the benefits, it makes you want him to get there. And that's, but yeah, I'm sure you can get this on DVD. I'm sure you can get it.
Yeah, it's been a good year, I think, since it was.
Yeah, so Love Film, this, get your hands on this. This is one of the better films in the last few years. And then next week, apparently, just a couple more. It's all French because the Tsar was in French as well. There are a couple of films which are allegedly being released in the UK on Friday, which I assume means four cinemas in London. One is Police, which everybody who follows the Césars, which is about four people, will know that this had a massive count at the Césars. It was like 10 nominations or 11 nominations or something stupid. But the reason is because they nominated about half the cast. There's about five of those are acting nominations. It's really stupid because it's a massive ensemble. And I think they put the two stars lead and then everyone else supporting.
I think this is on my local art house cinema, Police.
It's nowhere near me. It's not coming out anywhere near me. Quite a good little film. It's about a crime investigation unit, and the crime investigation unit is tailored towards child abuse. And what it does is it doesn't follow any of the cases through, so you just have these cases coming in as they would do to that unit. Because the thing is, that unit in real life, if they had they'll only have these people in for a certain amount of time. They'll interview the parent or whoever's doing the abuse. They'll interview the child and then send them on their merry way and hope that the French equivalent of the Crown Prosecution Service puts them away. Very often that's the end of their involvement in the investigation. So the film reflects that. And you've got a group of people who are all in there, and the kicker is that there is a female photographer who is also the director of the film. I think she wrote it as well, called Mai Wen. She's there photographing them, following them around for a project. It's one of these ones where the problem is also its strength. The strength is that it's realistic, because there's only a limited amount of involvement that these people in the unit have with the cases. But then again, there's nothing really to get emotionally involved with, because you just have these people coming in, and you'd have this miserable scene of like some bloke denying that he's been abusing his kid, or some woman denying that she's been abusing her kid. There's a lot of women who are the suspects, and so I'm making this sound depressing, and it's not an easy watch. It's not a fun film. It reminds me of a film from a few years ago which I watched because Isabelle Carré was in it. It's called God's Officers, and that was about an abortion clinic, and it's very similar in that film. You just have people coming in, and then they give them advice, and then they go off and never see them again. And I think that did the similar things better, because it doesn't try to tack. It didn't try at all to tack anything on. It was literally slice of life. This is what goes on at these people's in these people's job. And then what would happen is it would just lay back and breathe. You'd have like a scene of someone having a cigarette for about a minute, and you need it. You need that because you've just been seeing these horrible, horrible things. This does it in different ways. So when the plotting stops, where so that you've had the next line of people come in that they're questioning, then they try and put subplots in between the characters, yeah. And it doesn't work. Because it doesn't work as well, because it's like they're trying to shoehorn it in. So overall,
mixed.
Again, this is unlike Lazare. I couldn't recommend this broadly at all, because the subject matter is heavy going, and it's not the most successfully done thing, but it is well acted in general. I don't think it deserved five nominations, but then again. Very few films do. It is worth checking out if you are in the mood for something serious, and when it does try for the occasional lighter moment, and they're very sorely needed.
Did it win any of these César awards?
I will just actually, he says while talking, I'm going to out all of my IMDb-ing. I don't think it might have won. I think it won a tech. It might have won screenplay or something. I'm just clicking on the awards now. editing and most promising actress, because they stupidly have most promising actress, and I can barely remember the woman, the girl
most
who was
promising,
the most promising actress
in
it at all.
It's like the
yes, they have this. This is a joke, and the girl from The Child. I'm mentioning it again, Deborah Francois. She used to get nominated in Most Promising Actress. It took her like 3 times to win it. So she didn't win it for the Child. She didn't win it for The Page Turner, and she ended up winning it for The First Day of the Rest of Your Life. Very good film. Check that out. That is broadly recommendable. And like this, but yeah, this got nominated for Editing in Most Promising Actress, 2 Best Actresses, Cinematography, Director, Film, Original Screenplay, Sound, Editing and Mixing. By the look of it, supporting 3 supporting actors and a supporting actress. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 actually, if you include Most Promising Actress.
They really loved this film.
Yeah, it was a filler. It's got your boy Nicholas Duvauchel in it as well. He's one of the cops, and probably the best performance in there is by a former rapper called Joey Starr. I know French rappers, I know, but he really delivers. The name actress in this is Karen Viard, who's been in lots of, she's very familiar.
She's in Patiche.
She is in Patiche. She's also in L'Enfer, the Dany Stanovich, Keith Lossky trilogy. It was, you had Heaven with Cate Blanchett, then you had L'Enfer, so Hell, with Emmanuel Béart, her and Marie Gillen. And then the third one, which nobody ever saw. The Poles actually did make the third one, but I watched it online. It was okay. It wasn't great. Anyway, so Karen Viard, she's a very familiar face, and they do really do love her, the French. And the other film out, allegedly, is Requiem pour un Suisse, which is Mélanie Laurent, second week in a row for Mélanie Laurent.
Wow.
And this is very much out of the commercial end of French cinema. It's your bog standard thriller with an assassin up for one last job.
Is she just acting in this one?
She's fine in it. She does what it says on the she does what she needs to, but and it's extremely smoothly put together, actually. It's but it's an exercise in turf polishing. There's just not enough of a story there. The screenplay is really pretty bad. But when you consider how nice it looks and how smooth it is, and the fact you've got Laurent, I can see in a way why it's got a release. I can kind of see in a way why it's got a release, because after Inglourious Basterds, she's a name. She's The Beginners, which got attention. So she is a name.
She's
going to
sell tickets, yeah.
So you're at least going to have a chance. How big that chance is, I don't know. This might just be like the way that 5 or 10 years ago, random Isabelle Huppert films like Gabrielle made art houses and then were completely forgotten.
Yeah.
But so this one, I couldn't. If you really, really, really like Mélanie Laurent, then have a look and then blame yourself afterwards.
Okay.
That's all. It's all I got to say on that one.
That was the French Requiem, quarter of the podcast.
French, yeah. This isn't going to be every week. and no César noms for sorry, Melanie.
Oh, maybe next year.
So we're shifting onto a different country now.
Yeah, I'm just going to blitz through Himizu, which is a Japanese film by Sion Sono. I think I pronounced that right. Which is very, very depressing. It's about the end of the world, or the end of Japan at least. It's like they've gone through a nuclear contamination. And parents want their kids to die to to relieve pressure and expense. Or maybe just for them as well, I don't know. And everybody's angry. And it's about this sort of, I wouldn't call it a love story, it's sort of just a tentative relationship between this young 18-year-old guy and this 18-year-old girl who were in the same class at school, or were, because they don't go to school anymore. And it's sort of like an anti-Norwegian Wood, in that it treats tragedy completely doesn't romanticize their relationship at all, and tragedies not used to heighten any sort of affection between them. It's just sort of a backdrop. And it's shot really well, actually. It's sort of like a low budget, it's a sort of like digital video kind of thing, which I think is a creative decision. I'm pretty sure we can get a budget big enough. It's good. I mean, it's very effective, but it's sort of one of these films that's repetitive, and he uses a lot of techniques to make it seem trippier than it is.
Right.
So there's that kind of lots of dream sequences and chaotic editing, and everybody's kind of shouting and fighting, and it all just gets a little bit tiresome, which is a shame, because it's a good idea.
A bit like Blindness in the sort of, is that too?
Less exploitative than Blindness, but more boring than Blindness, but less exploitative sort of thing. Okay. And it's very long. It's like 2 hours 20 minutes, and it could easily be, it could easily be 100 minutes, and that'd be fine. But I he's an interesting filmmaker. I don't know if you've seen any of his stuff. He's done Cold Fish.
No, I don't think so.
Love Exposure. No.
Really? That sounds like porn.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, fine.
I haven't seen that one, so it might be, but
right.
But yeah, give it a go if you like bleak dystopic stories. So how about we talk about an English film? Or a film in English?
It would be nice. Or anything not French.
Yeah. Well, I guess this is American. It doesn't have any English money in it, does it?
Well, it has some extraordinarily dodgy English accents in it.
It does. But we're talking about Snow White and the Huntsman. Directed by Rupert Sanders, who...
What a name.
Yeah.
What a name. He just sounds like a top.
Yeah, good old Roop has made a film with... Kristen Stewart. And Charlize Theron. It's called Snow White and the Huntsman. Chris Hemsworth's the Huntsman, Charlize Theron's the Wicked Queen, and Kristen Stewart is Snow White, the fairest of them all.
What's the basic plot for anybody who might not be familiar with either the Disney film or the basic story?
Well, the basic story is Snow White's the princess who's cast aside by her mother-in-law, who marries her father and then murders him.
As you do.
And is obsessed with looking brilliant and being the fairest in the kingdom. So later on, when Snow White comes of age, the Wicked Queen tries to hunt her down and kill her. But there are many people who want to save Snow White.
There's always a but. There's always a but.
It's a battle. It's a very straightforward battle between good and evil.
Between blonde and brunette.
Yeah, blondes are evil, everyone.
According to this film, at the very least.
What do you think?
What did I think? I thought it was watchable. Just about.
It's very...
Just about watchable.
It was kind of Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves of the Snow White generation.
I was thinking more Robin Hood, Ridley Scott. Yeah,
well, Robin Hood in any case. But
yes.
I wasn't really expecting the medieval vibes coming through it.
Yeah, there are hints and there are various films. Lord of the Rings. A lot of Ridley Scott films, actually. Gladiator, at the beginning, there's a very Gladiator-ish vibe to the opening battle.
Braveheart.
Lord of the Rings, when it gets in a bit more fantasy directions later on, there's lots of Oh, I see what you mean with the Robin Hood, because it ends up getting into that whole... Yeah. Oh, yeah. I see where you're going with that one. Yeah, the thing with this is, it's so emo, it's untrue. It's really grime and dirty. I think it's pretty emo.
I was expecting more emo. I was expecting more stylization than we got. It felt more... just more kind of... just traditional.
Standard?
Yeah, battle, landscape, religious undertones. Snow White's reciting the Lord's Prayer in the first scene we see her. Which I think's odd.
That was actually quite interesting. That did take me by surprise a little bit. I suppose the thing with this is it's a very big budget film.
And, 75 million, I think.
Yeah, and the special effects are very front and centre. It's just one of these ones where you know why they cast her, because she's in a franchise that made an absolute bucket load of money.
Yeah.
And so that's why they cast her. And I'd be really interested to know if they always wanted to have it so serious and so... obsessed with not necessarily darkness, but you know what I mean, the sort of griminess. It's all very dungeony, and the swampy. Woods are very so I wonder if they were always going to go in this direction, so they thought, you know what, let's cast it an emo queen, or if they thought, this girl is in a franchise that made a load of money, we'll cast her, and because we've cast her, let's go in a more emo-ish direction. I know you don't think they fully went emo, but
Casting seems very of the moment, like Chris Hemsworth's the boy.
Yeah, he is the boy recently, yeah. And Theron. Apparently in the earlier casting rumours, Winona Ryder's name came up quite a bit. I think she might have done a bit better, because I wasn't really that sold on Charlize whenever she had to start shouting.
Is that because Winona wants to be young again?
Well, channeling her in a 16-year-old shoplifter. Yeah, well, wouldn't you? I think Theron too overcooked. When pushed.
Yeah, it got a bit ugly in places.
Yeah, and that's a tone issue, and I blame the director for that one. Isn't it his debut?
I really hope not.
I think it was. I'm pretty sure I went on IMDb and there wasn't anything else. I'm disdainful enough to not actually bother to type them now. I'm pretty sure it's his debut. The accents, I mean, what is it? I mean, I'm going to go off a mini rant here. I mean, Prometheus last week, we didn't actually mention this. Rapace, I mean, what was she attempting? I mean, I'm assuming it was English.
Yeah.
But there were many times you're just thinking, what on earth is that? And more so with Theron, actually. I thought Stuart, at least she was pretty consistent with what she was doing.
I think so, yeah. Theron's intonation, more than the actual accents, probably the intonation was really odd.
Yeah. Yeah, and Hemsworth trying Scottish. Yeah.
That was a bolt from the blue.
Yeah, it's just... I suppose the problem is, when you've got America and there are potted plants in my garden that are older than that country, and there isn't a... they don't have the royal tradition. Well, they have our royal tradition, and then they decided they didn't want anything of it. So it's almost as if, because this is to do with kings and queens and, well, queens and princesses, they've got to have English accents. And because the Huntsman is he's got to have a regional accent, and then the only one that we will accept in a big budget film is Scottish, because heaven forbid somebody be Brummy or have a Liverpool accent or Geordie. A Manchester accent or Mackham. I mean, it's just feeding into the lie that is. I mean, because nobody talks like it. It's the fake received pronunciation BBC thing that used to exist in the 1950s, and I don't know anyone who speaks like that. And I went to when I went to university, I didn't meet anyone who spoke like that.
I really would have preferred if they'd just done their American accents, because it's not an inherently English story. I know there's royalty in it, but...
Wasn't it Brothers Grimm? What were they, German? Austrian? Something like that?
Yeah, Danish, maybe?
Middle European or whatever. He didn't pretend to be Mads Mikkelsen. I'm just really getting tired. I mean, it's just so many decades of bad English accents, which aren't English accents. This is the thing. They're doing it because they think it's an English accent. It's not an English accent. Yeah. Just really gets in my craw. And I don't mind necessarily Stewart's, because at least what she was doing was, it wasn't distracting as much, because it was continuously the same. So, because as long as whatever you do, as long as it's the same, that's fine. It's like Sean Connery, if he's not going to attempt an accent, that's fine, as long as what you're doing is the same all the way through. Bjork in Dancer in the Dark, famously, well, it's not famously at all because nobody ever talks about it. She's playing someone Czech, or is it Czech?
Yeah, Czech immigrant, yeah,
and she's just talking in her usual Icelandic accent. I mean, nobody complains that Bjork didn't do it. Well, this is the thing, nobody complains that Bjork didn't do accent. Because nobody cares.
Because nobody knows a Czech accent would be like, or most people, compared to...
Apart from Lucy Safarova, maybe, or Thomas Berdych. Random Czech tennis players that I'm just listing off now. And so it's just as long as what you're doing is consistent, it doesn't matter. You can not have an accent, and it doesn't even become an issue. Like Kevin Costner, when he tried to do an accent in 13 days, people complained about it. But then again, because he's Kevin Costner, people complained about his accent in Robin Hood when he actually wasn't doing one.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. So if that's the case, you may as well not, because you may as well do your normal accent and not try than butcher something.
And it was...
anyway.
Yeah. This was so self-serious. Too self-serious for its own good, which was... It got really grating.
Yes. Yeah, and it was felt a lot longer than it actually was. I think the pacing was a major issue with this film.
It was long, wasn't it? Two and a bit hours.
I think it was actually just over two. I've got the page up, so I'll tell you. And it's gonna have a lot of credits. This, yeah, it's 127 with credits, so it's probably only 2 hours. But it feels a good two and a half, doesn't it?
Yeah, long time to spend with these people, definitely.
What did you think about the dwarves?
I thought the dwarves may as well not have been there.
And why have so many famous people? They've got everyone from Ian McShane. Yeah. Lovejoy. Sod, whatever the Americans know him for, he's Lovejoy. Hoskins, Winston, Nick Frost, Eddie Marzan, Toby Jones. I hope they got paid.
For their 3 minutes.
Yeah. Hoskins, what's he doing? Anyway. That was when it was going a bit Lord of the Rings.
It just typified the fact that this wasn't really about the light. It was more about the battle and the who will be my brother. Do you remember that line?
Yes. So with this in general. I think technically, even though I think there are some plus points on the technical side, with the sound and the photography, I actually looked up who shot this. It's a guy called Greg Fraser, Australian guy, and he shot Bright Star.
Okay.
Right, and I cannot believe that the guy who shot Bright Star, because I thought that was just a gorgeously photographed film, shot this. And then I realised that when I watched, because Bright Star's by Jane Campion, when I watched The Portrait of a Lady, which was also by Jane Campion, I was watching it and I swore blind, I was 100% sure Christopher Doyle shot that film. And then I went and looked afterwards and he didn't. So I think there's a lot to be said for the actual director's influence over the visual style of the film. It's not just a case of you can hire a cinematographer who's doing brilliant work and they're going to do brilliant work all the time. Because when they got to the fantasy bits, there's a what would you call it, the sanctuary part. It's all like a forest, and it's supposed to be, I got the feeling it was supposed to be a lot more beautiful than it actually was. I wasn't really being wowed by the visuals in the way that I think they were going for, and it's I think the colours were a bit too stark.
Yeah,
and it just didn't really, it didn't seem the colour scheme of it didn't seem smooth, and it just felt like there was just too much of it that, and so I'm thinking, how did the guy who shot Brightside do this? And it's because that's Jane Campion's film. It's not necessarily the guy who shoots. He's got to do what the director's telling him.
Yeah,
and it's like Wong Kar-wai when going back to Doyle again. When he's not, I mean, he's done multiple films where Christopher Doyle hasn't shot a lot of it, and you wouldn't know. And you just got to come to a conclusion at some point that while things may be nicely shot, it's the director. It really is the director, and. On this one, I mean, don't get me wrong, there's some nice shots here and there, but it wasn't Wowsville.
Yeah, I was expecting it to be more like that, more kind of polished.
Stylized.
Yeah, and that was welcome for me, like, in some ways, that it wasn't...
When it got to the sanctuary
bit. Yeah, that it wasn't all style and no substance.
Mm.
But it wasn't much of either, really, in the end.
No, I mean, it was... I have a bit more goodwill to it than I actually think, because I think a lot of times when you have special effects-laden films, they're just there for the sake of it. Whereas I think with this one, the special effects did sort of tend to bleed into the atmosphere or bleed into the surroundings in a more believable way than most. It wasn't as if it was like, okay, here's just the special effects and it looks fake, or not even looking fake, it just looks like here's the special effects. Whereas with this, I did buy it in the sort of in the world that we're in, within the film, and but it just goes on and on and on and on, much like this review. it suffers from the same sort of things that Lord of the Rings, the second film, does, in that there's a lot of people walking.
And there's a lot of people walking through forests aimlessly. That takes up a huge chunk of the middle section of the film.
Yeah. One thing I did like, though, again, this is a theme for the week, is that I did like that they didn't go in the sort of obvious ways with any potential romance. They didn't over-egg it, they underplayed it, which was a rather refreshing surprise. Although the problem is that what that led to was when they did go for little bits here and there, it's a bit like Van Helsing, where suddenly after like an hour and a half, you're about to go to the final battle and they kiss or whatever, or there's a declaration or something or other, and you're just like, well, you haven't really been going that direction, I don't really need it now, and if you're not going to follow it through, then why bother? But I did like that they didn't like over-egg, like turn it into some like massive romance between the Australian and the Paramore fan.
Yeah. So how do you think this compares with the first Snow White film of the year, Mirror Mirror?
Yes. Yes, this is the sort of, it's a topic in and of itself, the two Snow White films. What I got from this is it depends which one you saw first. And so for years and years and years, I'd seen Airplane many times. And it's a really funny film. And it's not a cinematic classic, but it's a funny film. And then if you've seen Airplane, and then you go back and see Airport, which was Oscar nominated in the early 70s, yeah, it's so serious. And it's so overwrought in comparison, because you've already seen it lampooned.
It's terrible.
So it's on a high, yeah. But the whole point is, especially with Airplane, what makes it funnier is if you've already seen Airport, and you've seen it done as the serious drama, and then they're just completely taking the mick out of it. So with this, it's the other way around, in that the Mirror Mirror came first, and Mirror Mirror is the one that's really tongue in cheek, very cynical, very funny, entertaining. I mean, nothing. It tries to be entertaining all the way through. I mean, then you have this, and that's what makes, I think, it feel even more serious and even more plodding in comparison, if you've already seen Mirror Mirror.
It's incredibly camp, incredibly fun, sort of complete departure from Snow White and the Huntsman.
Okay.
It doesn't take itself too seriously. It's just... it
doesn't take itself seriously, full stop. Yeah,
it's frothy. It's all the performances are really light and kind of carefree. Hammer is really, really good.
Nathan Lane's very funny in it. And Julie Roberts came to play. I mean, she just flat out came to play. I'm going to have fun with this, no matter what. Whether anyone else is having fun watching it, I don't care. I'm going to have fun doing it. I think if you compare the dwarves, it's really quite clever how in Mirror Mirror they're
like these set them renegades up. Aren't they?
Yes. Yeah. And so it's continuously twisting the assumptions on its head, whereas in Snow White and the Huntsman, it's continuously going down the tradition, as traditional a route as you could go for.
Although I think, like, to say what both of them do together is Snow White is a character, they kind of give her an added motivation, like a stronger sense of self-sufficiency, because if you've seen the Disney film, then she's pretty much just a sap who waits for the prince to rescue her.
I think Stuart was talking about this on a red carpet or so. I did hear some interview, it might have been one of the ones on Film 4 where they have like people being interviewed, and she was basically saying that that character won't work in a modern setting with how women are today.
Yeah.
It would just I think the subtext of what she's saying is it would be sexist if you did it that way.
Yeah.
And nobody would want, and nobody would, it wouldn't be believable in anymore.
Yeah.
In that respect, I think between the two Snow Whites, I wasn't that impressed with Lily Collins I was more impressed by everyone else around her. I thought everyone else around her was really good, and she was just there in the middle, and she wasn't bad at all. I'm not disparaging the performance in any negative way. I just think she was just there and everyone else was having a riot, and she kind of had to be that way because you couldn't have her trying to get in on the act as well, because the Evil Queen's the Evil Queen, and so if you're having someone deliciously being the Evil Queen, then fine.
Yeah, she's got to take a step back to some extent, but
yeah, she's the straight man, because it's a comedy, she's the straight man. Where, and so I think Stuart had probably more to do, but and because it's so hand-wringingly serious, it really is. It's on a hiding to nothing in a way. I mean, many more people will see this film.
Yes, I think so.
Than Mirror Mirror.
Although, if you're looking to take your kids to one of them, you're gonna have to go for Mirror Mirror.
Of course. And I think as well, the other reason it's a bit of an unfair comparison the other way around is I think the did Snow White? I would guess Snow White had more of a budget than Mirror Mirror.
Well, I think it's something like 75 to 40, something like that.
Yes, right. Because it's a tarsome scene film.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the thing. I mean, the costumes, and it's more the art direction. The costumes in both are really are good. They're probably better in Mirror Mirror, the costumes, but I think the art direction in the sets and the whole visual world that they've got for Snow White, I think it's purely because of the budget. They've got more, so that's why it's better.
Yeah.
But I think it's more, we'll CG it for Mirror Mirror. We're not going to be able to build big sets or what have you, or have them extraordinarily detailed, because they haven't got the money.
Yeah, I mean, I can see both of these films kind of having an Oscar play on the craft side. I think, obviously, Eiko Ishioka's costumes in Mirror Mirror, she recently died.
Former winner.
For Dracula. Yeah.
Dracula.
And
she's a bit of a legend in the field.
She's very well respected, so she could get a nomination, but I think she's going to need some support, guild support, maybe.
Yes, yeah. It also depends on whether the I think she's got a good chance of a nom. I don't think she's got much of a chance for a win, but I think there's a decent enough. I think there's enough with the story and the exterior politics going for her. Snow White, I mean, sound design's very good. I mean, I could see that happening. I think
Snow White's main plays for makeup, maybe. I mean, yeah, I don't know how much is CG, but I know there's definitely some makeup on Charlize in the later stages.
Yes, I mean, what happens is they get little 10-minute DVDs where they detail exactly what was real makeup and what was CG'd afterwards, which is what, I mean, because a lot of people really laughed when Benjamin Button got nominated, because they just thought, well, surely it's all CG. But then again, you haven't seen the test reel.
That's true.
That actually tells you what it is. So I mean, that's why it's not really. I think for most people, if you have lists of what you think from it was the best in each category from certain years, I mean that's pretty down the bottom of what you're actually interested in judging the makeup, because you haven't got the frame of reference, because you're just guessing on the end result and you don't really know what went into it. But yeah, I Mirror Mirror overall, I really enjoyed. I thought it was fun.
Yeah.
And I think it ruined Snow White for me in a way. I don't think I would ever have thought Snow White was a good film. I think it's got enough flaws in it.
I think
that would always prevent me from saying, yeah, this is a really good film, Snow White. But Mirror Mirror sort of cut it off at the knees and it highlighted some of the flaws a bit more.
Yeah, and said, why aren't you having more fun with this story? Which is why
so serious?
Yeah. Well, maybe we should end there. Why so serious?
Yes, 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 and maybe we can have some appropriate why so serious music.
I wanted to say that we have a new blog.
Yes, we do.
moodforpodcast@blogspot.com.
We've also got a Twitter account. Is that Mood for Podcast?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, Mood for Podcast. What I'll be doing on my blog, inthemoveablog.blog.co.uk, is I'll be putting up the most recent few, because I've only got a certain amount of hosting.
Yeah.
Right? So I'll be putting up the most recent few just to stream, but then you'll be able to. But you'll also be able to stream it on the normal website, moveablogspot.co.uk. And you'll be able to download that or stream it there as well. So there'll be various avenues of getting it. And it'll be linked on your ultimateaddict.com as well.
And it's on iTunes as well.
There you go. All the bases are covered.
We did get a few downloads last week, so...
I don't think it's going to be making any charts.
Yeah.
Right.
Have you got any parting words?
Well, I've had my bold statement of the week. Right. You got a bold statement of the week?
I was just going to say, tune in next week to see if the child gets a third mention in a row.
The bold statement is that you don't think I'll be able to get it in. Or you do think I'll be able to get it in without pre-thinking it. It'll just naturally come to me.
Yeah, I'm going to take bets.
In fact, should we just part? Did you actually like the child? I've no idea. Because I don't
I've
love
never
it,
seen
by the way.
Child. Why don't I see the child and then we can talk about it next week and it will make the podcast?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's a 7 out of 10. It's not like I love this thing, honestly.